and having a boat over in Cubitt's Yacht Basin at Chiswick. And while I was there, I noticed that there were two naval officers talking to Commander Lightoller aboard of a Sundowner, his yacht. When they went, Commander Lightoller said, "Could you give me a hand with stripping out the Sundowner?" I said, "Certainly. What's it in aid of, then?" He said, "Well, the Navy wished to commandeer the Sundowner to go to Dunkirk to bring some of the British troops back."
Did you know anything about what was happening at Dunkirk?
No, it had only been rumours at that time, but the troops were being evacuated. But not an awful lot of news on the wireless or in the papers at that particular time.
So you didn't realise how serious it was?
No. No, and Commander Lightoller pointed out that the Germans had advanced far more rapidly than was expected. But Dunkirk was cut off, and the Navy considered it essential to have every type of craft that could carry people to bring the troops back.
I think you were a Sea Scout at the time, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, I had been the first Malt Lake Sea Scouts for a considerable number of years. So anyway, I said, "Well, I'll certainly give you a hand to unrig the boat, and if you want a hand to come with you, I'll come with you." I said, "Well, Roger, my eldest son, is coming down, but he won't be here till this evening. If you'd like to come, I'll warn you that it's not exactly going to be a pleasure cruise, but if you'd like to come with us, then we'll be only too pleased to have you."
Were you wearing uniform when Lightoller saw you?
No, in civilian clothes. So we set to. We took all the gear out from down below to make as much room as possible, and also to get out anything that was likely to cause a fire. We stripped the galley as well as the cabins. We filled the bath with fresh water. We filled up the water tanks with fresh water. We took the mast down. We removed everything from on deck so to give more room on the deck. And by the evening, when Roger arrived, we got everything ready to go. And the orders were, Cubitt's Yacht Basin being a tidal basin, we had to lock out the next morning at high water. We would have a naval lieutenant join us. Two more of the motor yachts from Cubitt's Yacht Basin were to go as well. And we were to meet up with other yachts down towards the London Embankment. So we moved out of Cubitt's Yacht Basin the next morning. We fell in with several other yachts on the way down the Thames until we got to Charing Cross Bridge at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, where we had to come to a halt. And we were informed at that time that owing to the conditions on the beach, the evacuation was being cancelled. So we remained there for that night.
Which date was this?
That would be the last day of May. No, sorry, the second last day of May.
30th of May.
30th of May. The next morning, we're informed that the evacuation was still on, and we would proceed to Gravesend for orders at Gravesend. So we got underway, went down to Gravesend. We were halted again at Gravesend. There we took aboard stores of food, cigarettes, tobacco, etc. And then had to wait till daylight the next morning to sail for Ramsgate. So at approximately 0700 on the morning of June the 1st, we left for Ramsgate. Being a fairly fast motor vessel, she left most of them behind, so we arrived off Ramsgate on our own. Went into Ramsgate Harbour, tied up alongside of a pier, and reported that we were ready and fit to sail for Dunkirk.
Were there any signs at Ramsgate of the evacuation taking place?
Oh yes, there were trawlers, tugs, all kinds of craft, motorboats coming in and unloading troops at that time.
What did the troops look like?
They looked very worn out. Very worn out indeed. But I must say that I was greatly impressed with the work of Women's Voluntary Services there, who were on the landing stage to meet them as they came ashore. They helped them. There were ambulances laid on. All the men were taken ashore, given tea, hot soup. They were all given postcards to send to their relatives. And the Women's Voluntary Services looked after them very well indeed.
Were there thousands of troops that you saw at Ramsgate?
Must have been. Literally thousands passed through while we were there.
Did this shock you to see the scale of it?
No, I wouldn't say I was shocked by it. I was astonished to think that we'd had to evacuate the coast of France, but under the circumstances it was quite understandable that the men would be in such a condition. Knowing they'd been retreating from possibly 100 miles inside of France, and knowing the distance had had to withdraw, and that they were literally helpless against the German tanks, and all had been left with are the rifles, I could understand the condition they were in, having gone days, nights, without sleep, without food, or even, as I was to find out later on, by the troops we had brought back, they'd even been denied water. If they wanted a drink of water, they had to pay for it.
To French civilians?
To the French civilians. Mm. And of course food was in a short supply in any case.
So what did you do next?
Well, the Navy wanted to commandeer the Sundowner. Oh, Commander Lightoller informed them that he was an ex-RNR commander. He had commanded a destroyer in the 1914-18 war, and if anyone was going to take the boat to Dunkirk, he was going to take it himself with his son and myself. And the Navy agreed. Being in the Merchant Navy, I was covered by the Maritime Act. Commander Lightoller and his son Roger signed on 2124 agreement, and at that the Navy were happy. So at 10 o'clock on the morning of the 1st of June, we set sail for Dunkirk.
Can you describe the voyage across the Channel?
It was one of the most peaceful scenes I've ever seen in the Channel as we left Ramsgate Harbour. The seas were dead flat, bright sunlight, a really beautiful day. And so it remained until we about halfway across the channel. And then we sighted a yacht on fire, and two or three men waving to us. So we closed this yacht. It turned out to be a Westerly on her way back from Dunkirk. She had three naval hands aboard and two soldiers that she picked up. They informed us that they'd stopped evacuating from the beach at Dunkirk, as conditions were too bad then with the Luftwaffe. And they also informed us that the sooner we got aboard the better, we had 200 gallons of petrol aboard. So we got them aboard quickly, pushed off. When we were a few hundred yards away, an explosion, and up went the yacht Westerly. We proceeded on, and by this time a boat still only just less than halfway across the channel, We could see were black clouds of smoke coming up from the burning oil tanks. Shortly after picking up the crew from Westerly, we were attacked by three German fighter planes. But fortunately for us, a destroyer was coming up rapidly astern of us. He opened up his 4.7s on the fighters, and they turned tail and fled.
Were the fighters strafing you?
No. Before they were close enough to open fire on us, the shell bursts from a Worcester, the destroyer, put them off, and they thought better of taking on a destroyer. A turned tail and flew back towards the French coast. However, that was just the start. As we got near to the French coast, so the preponderance of German aircraft became obvious to us. The first one whose attention we attracted was a Stuka dive bomber, who came down at us. Commander Lightoller stood up on the bow of a Sundowner. I stood alongside the wheelhouse, and Rogers stood at the wheel. And Lightoller watched the Stuka, keeping his eye on it till the last second, sung out to me, hard aboard. I sung out through the door to Roger. We turned very sharply, being an ex-naval pinnace, that was why she was so rapid on her helm, and the bomb landed on our starboard side. Round he went, came round for another go. Lightoller watched him closely. The next time he took a chance and sent a harder starboard. Round she twiddled, and the bomb landed this time only a very short distance away on the port quarter. The water came aboard from the bomb. We rolled heavily, got out of it, still glad enough, away he flew. We now sort of straightened up, come back on an even keel, then a fighter plane came down. And as the fighter came down at us, that particular moment, Lightoller thought she was a bit sluggish, hopped down below and found we were taking water from these two near misses. I started to build a pump up, came flying up again. Watched this fighter who by now was coming in a straight line astern. Unfortunately, his youngest son had been a pilot in the Air Force and had told him that when a fighter plane was making an attack, just a second or two before it fired its guns, it would lift the nose of the plane and align the guns. Now, if he was watching for that moment, and as he thought the plane was about to lift, he sung out to go hard aboard, which we promptly did, and the bullets came flying down the starboard side. Plane came round, had another go. We twisted, we turned. But that was the start of the fighter planes. After that, they accompanied us pretty well to the harbour entrance. As by now, the beach had become untenable for troops. We approached the harbour entrance to go into the entrance.
To go what?
Into the entrance of the harbour, to go alongside the piers and embark troops from there. By this time, several ships had been sunk outside of the harbour, including one large transport that lay on its side. And as we got close to the harbour entrance, a large transport was making for harbour entrance. He was attacked by three Stuka dive bombers, and she completely disappeared from our sight. And we'd slowed down, almost come to a stop. And as we lay there, so slowly she emerged from midst the warm spray and water, proceeded on into the harbour, and we followed her in, pushing away all the debris from the sunken ships and the sunken transport. We made our way up into the harbour, being low tide. The water level was so far down the piers that we made for the destroyer Worcester, who had come to our rescue. We went alongside of his after quarter, being the lowest part, so we could transfer troops from a destroyer aboard of us. As we were making fast alongside, there was a colossal explosion, a big flash of light. I couldn't see anything, I couldn't hear anything. And my impression was, my God, I'm dead. The next second there was another colossal bang and flash. And when I could see, we'd made fast right underneath his after 4.7s that were firing directly over the top of us. Great relief to me to find that out, incidentally. But in the meantime, Commander Lightoller had gone aboard, told him we'd take as many troops off of her as we could. The captain of the destroyer agreed, so we started taking them aboard. The scene was one that I shall always remember. The harbour mole leading down to the destroyer was absolutely cram-packed with soldiers. So tightly, they couldn't move. With no British aircraft at all, and only the destroyer's anti-aircraft fire to depend on, the German Air Force were just having a heyday. The fighters were coming straight along the mole, machine gunning all the way along it. The troops couldn't escape, they just had to stand there. There was such a crowd pushing them down all the time. And I felt very sorry indeed for them in those conditions. We carried on embarking the troops. We realised early on that there were so many to come. Of necessity, we would have to get them to part up with their gear. And with the idea of keeping the weight down as much as possible, we persuaded them to part with their boots, which, if anyone's ever worn an army boot, they'd appreciate the weight of it and that could be saved. The hardest job was getting to part with the rifles. We managed to convince them that for every few rifles that came aboard, there'd be one more soldier that wouldn't. So we had them dumping all their gear over the side into the harbour. We got over 50 aboard down below. Then we started piling on deck. When we got approximately 130 aboard, sundown was so low in the water that we couldn't take any more, not we had any room left on deck then. So we cast off from the destroyer and proceeded out in the harbour.
Were they all British or were any of them foreign?
All British as far as I know. It was impossible to speak. I was attending on top of a wheelhouse and set up a first aid station there, and attending to the wounded as they came aboard or as they took their turn. Now, I never did get down below any further than the actual wheelhouse. And of course I was so tightly packed in down below that really it would have been impossible to move about down there.
And they were all soldiers, no civilians?
All soldiers. Although, of course, such was the state that you didn't know if they were soldiers or if they were anyone in soldier's uniform.
What kind of wounds did you see?
Mainly machine gun bullet wounds or shrapnel wounds from the bombs.
How serious were they?
Well, the destroyer's sick bay was taking me seriously injured, and we were taking those that would amount to, I suppose, what did you say, walking wounded.
What was their morale like?
Very low when they came aboard, but they kept thinking, well, we've let the country down. But we were trying to point out to them that they hadn't let the country down. The man who let the country down was Chamberlain. But had we been prepared for war, which in 1938 looked imminent, then things would have been different.
Did you have anything in the way of supplies on board? Food and water?
Yes, as stated, we'd taken on board food, cigarettes and tobacco at Gravesend that were supplied by the Navy there. And before we leaving Cuba's yacht base at Cheswick, we had filled up every available container that we had. In fact, on the previous day, we had gone round and borrowed buckets. The commander, Light Olive's foresight, he could foresee that one thing they were going to be in need of was fresh water. Not only for drinking, but for cleaning any wounds and out, etc.
What happened next?
Well, we were no sooner clear of the harbour than we were attacked by aircraft again. On this particular occasion, the first one out after us was a Stuka. He came hurtling out of nowhere. We had got the troops on deck to keep lookouts, and they suddenly sung out to say there was a Stuka on her tail. And he came hurtling down, lining straight at us. And from out of nowhere, a solitary Spitfire appeared, got in his tail, opened up, a Stuka burst into flames, a colossal cheer went up from all the troops on the deck, to be cut very short when it was obvious that Stuka was about to land on us. Fortunately, he dropped in the water just astern of us and blew up. After that, we were chased by enemy aircraft. They're pretty well halfway across the channel, as that Spitfire was the only British plane we saw throughout the day. One of our greatest problems, of course, was taking evasive action with the aircraft. The old Sundowner, she could turn literally on a sixpence, as the expression is. We didn't have much fear of the aircraft being able to actually hit us. But the experience we'd had previously with aircraft, what did worry us was being so deeply loaded and turning sharply. The Sundowner was heeling so far over. The bilge pump was only just keeping pace with the water we're taking in all the time. And with the destroyers and the cross-channel boats being used for evacuation coming past us at full speed and taking evasive action of aircraft themselves, were presenting us with very high washes. And in order to weather the washes, we had to be able to get round head first and ease down into the wash. If we'd taken any broadside, she'd have been liable to turn right over. But, of course, while we were taking evasive action, the destroyers and other ships were, occasionally we did get caught broadside onto the swell. And Light Holler, who was standing on the bow all the time, giving directions for steering to evade the aircraft, resorted to what he'd done previously when he was standing on an upturned lifeboat of a Titanic throughout the night, when a swell built up there. He was waving his arms to the others standing on the upturned boat to lean to the left, lean to the right, according to which way to meet the swell. And that is what we did for the troops on deck. Lightoller stood forward. I was still on top of the wheelhouse, so I could direct those on the after end. And fortunately, we managed to evade any heavy wash that would have otherwise turned us over.
I don't think we've previously mentioned that Lightoller was famous for having been on the Titanic.
Well, of course, anyone of my age more or less takes for granted that the name Lightoller is synonymous with the name Titanic. And Commander Lightoller was the second officer and senior surviving officer of the Titanic when she struck the iceberg and sank in the Atlantic.
This was in 1912, I think we ought to say.
In 1912, correct.
How did the rest of your voyage proceed then?
Once we were just over halfway across the channel, things quietened down, and we had the odd fighter plane chase us, but it wasn't the mass attack that we'd had up to then. And when we were in approximately a couple of miles of Ramsgate, we never saw another aircraft. So we proceeded on to Ramsgate. When we arrived at the harbour, we were told to lay off, wait for orders to enter. So we sung out and said, we've got 130 troops aboard. Can we unload as quickly as possible? Can we have ambulances standing by? At which they said, enter immediately. So as we went through the harbour entrance, word had been passed down from those on deck to those down below that we're going into the harbour now. And at sundown, it suddenly took a terrific lurch as those down below started struggling up. Those on deck tried to press over towards the side of the harbour we were going. And she very nearly turned turtle. And Commander Lightoller, who was in the wheelhouse at the time, sung out to everyone below to lay down. I got them back on deck to the other side, and she came up the rights, and we went alongside of a trawler laying alongside of a landing stage. The petty officer